Thank you very much for this very insightful and I'm sure thought-provoking book which we need to read. I mean, I don't want to take away from what people want to ask, but I think there are two issues that I would like you to address before I open it to everybody, because I think you highlighted very neatly how the occupation is a continuation of Zionism. It is not a rupture. And it is true when we deal a lot with Israeli historians or politicians, there is some tendency, especially among the left, to say, well, it was a mistake, it was not meant to be like this. You know, of course, there are people who are pushing for it, but the right solution to save Israel is a two-state solution. So you are offering, you're showing or you're arguing in your book that this is not the case, that it is not a watershed moment, it's a continuation, it's a process, not just a structure, it's a process that continues. But as you know, it's also a function of the powers game at the time. Now, the big question from the three elements that you've highlighted, which are very important, what do we do with the people, what do we do with the geography, and what do we do with the rights of the people? And basically say, with the rights of the people, the decision was, we decide what rights we give them, okay, they are non-citizens, okay, or non-citizen subjects, but they have some rights, which are human rights, and people wrote a lot about the human rights of Palestinians inside the West Bank as different from those in 48. When it comes to the second point you said is, what do we do with the population? Is we cannot do ethnic cleansing. Okay, that was also decided. But the issue I'm having problem with is how far your argument is that we cannot give the West Bank. Because how do you tackle the issue of the Alon plan? The Alon plan was a central plan of Israel. It never was an official document, but everybody knows about it, which was the terms that the Israeli establishment, this unity government, which was very important, agreed more or less on what is that they cannot give up in the West Bank. And the argument was, as far as I understood it, is that the territories were subject to negotiation. I mean, of all what Israel won in 67, the big chunks that it got in Sinai, West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, these were going to be bargaining chips. But with regards to the West Bank and Gaza in particular, it was clear Jerusalem is to be annexed, and this is exactly is there. But how much land of the West Bank, it was a debate of 25 to 40% of the West Bank. And I think the reason why 40% to 25% of the West Bank was precisely to get rid of the democracy, because most of the Palestinians did not leave in 48. So it's 67. So how do you settle this reality? I mean, because it's true, after 50 years, what we realize, the Palestinians are living on 50, 60% of the West Bank. But this commitment to annexing the West Bank de facto, if not de jure, how far do you combine this with the Alon plan? And also the point of intentionality, because one of the biggest problems in any politics is how far do we say this was really intentional like this in 1967? The fact that Zionism is a settler colonial project we can all agree upon. I mean, also Israeli agree upon it. And that any state project, it wants to expand. But there is the issue of the counterfactual, there's the issue of the resistance that limits the tactics. Zionism also evolved. Yeah. So just to handle that issue, just because it can help counter argument of saying, oh, well, you think all of them are just hate Arabs, you know? And just show that there is, how can we counter such an argument? Yeah. And then I'll take questions from
okay.
The
floor.
Yeah, but if you prefer that you sit down.
No, that's okay. Yes, two very, very good points. Of course, I didn't have time to go on into them. They are in the book. I think that what I tried to say, and maybe I didn't say it clear enough, that the debate inside Israel was, even in the 67 government, was between those who said, how do we rule them directly and how do we rule them indirectly? So the Alon plan, first of all, mapped the areas which we have to rule directly. And it didn't mean that the areas that are not ruled indirectly are not part of the scheme. Now, Alon, as you probably know, he had two versions. He said the indirect areas, and this reminds us of Oslo. At first he thought maybe we will allow the Jordanians, or we will share with the Jordanians control over those areas. And then he said, maybe it's much better to have Palestinian autonomy in those areas. But we have to decipher what the Israelis mean. Now we know better, but even then we understood it. What they mean by Palestinian autonomy. They mean by Palestinian autonomy, it's exactly what the open prison model comes into. You are autonomous in the open prison, in many ways, apart from the parameters around you. And I think this is what I meant in this respect. Of course, what complicated for the Israelis the situation was that Alon had a very clear strategic map. He said, we will transfer, or we will bring Jews from Israel into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip into places which are not densely populated by Palestinians. But then, alongside the official Israeli government, a messianic movement emerged, Gush Emunim, who had their own map. And it was exactly the opposite map of the government. They took the Bible as a map, and with the help of archaeologists, determined that they want to colonize and Judaize the areas where they believed were biblical sites. Now, all these biblical sites were in the midst of densely populated Palestinian areas. So when in 77, a government that is closed ideologically to this messianic movement comes to power, the two maps fused together, and therefore the 25 or 30% of Alon for direct rule becomes 60% of direct rule, and 40% was supposed to be autonomous long before Oslo, even at the time of the Sadat initiative and so on.
So we're going to take questions. Please just introduce yourself and make sure that it's a question rather than a comment, if possible.
So, yeah. Can you repeat the question? Because of these tapings.
So the question, if you can introduce yourself and give us a question. I'll collect three questions and then we'll have an answer.
My name is Sam. The question is, where do we go from here? Is Palestine going to continue to be occupied with peace process and dialogue? This is my question.
I have a similar question. It seems as if there is a plan to have take Palestinian farmland, demolish new homes Palestinians build to control the demographics, control the water, so they can't expand their population, but they can stay. What would put food on the table is to go farm for the settlers. So they create a market and they create a captive workforce, which can work for the Israelis. Is there any way that you can see forward where Palestinians, they can stop the theft of Palestinian land and that Palestinians can get their land back, their water back?
Okay, so the two questions, where do we go from here and how can we stop the theft of Palestinian land? You want to ask a question? Okay, go ahead.
Maybe from the Arab hour. Quick question. The 90s actually reminded us of, even if the Arabs, including the BA, the Palestinians, accepted Israel, it's not going to be enough. And you mentioned in the book that they have to accept Israel as a Jewish state. I think I know what it means. Can you elaborate more? If there's something more than the Palestinians would accept racist laws.
Is there more that the Palestinian can accept about the Jewishness of the state? Okay.
Yeah, maybe I understood you. If not, you'll tell me, because he was kind of a half a question if you stopped in the middle. So, but I think I know what you're asking, but I may be wrong. So. I apologize if it's not accepted. Sami, where do we go from here? I think that it's a very good question, but every physician and doctor would tell you that if you don't diagnose the illness correctly, you don't give the right remedy. And I think that for 50 years, those who were involved in the peace process, reconciliation effort, diplomatic, a quote, call it what you want, for good intentions or bad intentions, it doesn't matter, did not diagnose correctly the problem. And therefore, the solution they offered, the two-state solution, was not the right one. It had nothing to do with the reality on the ground. So the first thing we need to do, and this is urgent because, as you know, things on the ground are getting worse by the day, so we need to accelerate our efforts. We need to have a better analysis of what's wrong. And maybe in this room we have enough people who agree with my analysis, but outside this room, there's a lot of good people who do not share this analysis. So we need, and there are many people in the West Bank who would not share this analysis because they would see only the situation in the West Bank as the main problem, or people in Gaza, different Palestinian constituencies. So what we need is a united Palestinian position. We need a new definition of the Palestinian Liberation Project, and only the Palestinians can do it. And we need a Palestinian dialogue about the alternative for what the PA is offering. And until this will not happen, the international community would say to people like me, why are you trying to be more pious than the Pope? The PA wants two-state solution. Why are you talking about decolonization, change of regime? All they want is a small state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This is the right way forward. This is legitimate. So as long as there is no Palestinian, clear Palestinian position, a democratic Palestinian, an authentic Palestinian position on that, it would be very hard to move or change the macro picture. Now, this brings me to the second question. That doesn't mean that on the micro level there is nothing we can do. And the younger generation of Palestinians are showing us again and again that local struggles on water, on land, on agriculture. There's a whole area near Ramallah where women are running an ecosystem that endured the first intifada, the second intifada, and so on. There are the brave people who succeeded in struggling in Bilhain and places like this. And we have now the famous Ahed Tamimi who showed us a way forward, and the people who went to pray in Al-Aqsa and forced the Israelis to take out the magnetometers from the mosque. These are all small victories, of course, which do not change the reality at large, but it's also a structure. It's also a process of resistance. But it will not transform into a basic change of the reality if we will not have the same guidance that the ANC gave us when we supported apartheid, when we supported the anti-apartheid movement. We had a direction. And with all the respect we have, and we should continue with the BDS is not a vision. And we have to ask ourselves, BDS for what? And we don't have a clear Palestinian answer on this. We have our individual clear answers. But who am I? I can give you my answer. But what does it matter what Ilan Pappa thinks should be the solution? I wasn't elected by anyone to do this. Now, the question of a Jewish state, the nature of the settler colonial project is that and this is important to understand, that the indigenous population, the native population, are always perceived as aliens, as strangers. You know, the early Zionist settlers were very poor when they came to Palestine in the very early years of the 20th century. Had nothing. They didn't know how to cultivate land. They had nowhere to stay. And they were hosted, which was typical for an Arab society. They were hospitality. They were hosted by Palestinians in Jaffa, which was their first destination. And already there, in the first day in the new land, at night, probably under the light of an oil lamp, they started writing letters back home and diaries. And they were quite verbose. I mean, they wrote a lot, luckily for us historians. There's nothing that escaped them. Every mosquito bite that traveled them is registered by them. They didn't stop writing. And we have most of these things. They are accessible. And they write, you know, they have a dissonance. They were told that the land is empty. And here they are hosted by the people in the empty land. So how do they solve the dissonance? They decided that these people were aliens. Strangers. So they write, I'm staying in the house of this stranger that usurped my homeland after I returned to it. And this perception of the Palestinian as a stranger is also true about the liberal Zionists. I mean, there is a difference. They have this Jewish perception, which is very nice, which is say, even the stranger should be respected by you, which is very nice, but it's awful when it is implied to the Palestinians. This is the Israeli left. It says, we can tolerate, the word that would have irritated me most as a Palestinian is, we'll make a concession for you. You can have 15% of your own land. You can have some rights. This is the kind of the very concept of a Jewish state. So there is a very serious Jewish debate in Israel, what is a Jewish state? But this has nothing to do with the Palestinians. This is between secular Jews and religious Jews, Mizrahi Jews and Ashkenazi Jews, rich Jews and poor Jews. But this has nothing to do, the Palestinians are outside of this discussion because Palestine is a Jewish homeland and there is a question, what is the role of the Palestinians in it? When I said to Sami, what I haven't heard from the PLO since 1968, and it's not surprising because in 1982 the revolution ended. It got the strike that it has not recovered from. And in this respect, Sharon knew exactly what he was doing in 1982. We haven't heard since 1968 from the Palestinians, where do they see the settlers? We keep hearing what the settlers have in mind for the indigenous people, the native people. We don't hear from the native liberation movement. How do they see the settlers? Now, if you talk about, you say, the two-state solution, it means you say, oh, the settlers can have 80% of my homeland. Is that what you're saying? The settlers can have 80% of my homeland, and I'm okay with 20% divided to 8, with no connection between the various, and again, I refer to Leila's work on this, on the Bantustanization of the Palestinian as a kind of a solution.
I was hoping the Jewish people will come to their senses and they see it the way we see it. The only solution is to have one state where everybody can live an equal.
Yeah, but there are not enough Palestinians who say it. Sami, the problem are the Palestinians. The Palestinians don't say, when was the last time you heard the Palestinian leaders say, I think that the best solution for Palestine is a one-state solution? Abu Mazen says to the Americans, if you misbehave, something terrible would happen. There will be one democratic state in Palestine. He talks about one state, a democratic state, as a threat. I told him, because I know him and I met him. I said, why are you using it as a threat? This is a beautiful vision for the future. Why are you threatening the Americans that if they are not careful, there will be a democracy in Palestine?
My name is Udav. I have a question about how much the events that are happening in the Arab world, like Syria, Egypt, are connected to Israel, Palestine, and how much is this going to influence whatever final solution is going to come?
Yeah.
So how the regional situation will impact the solution? Okay.
It's because of the light you can see.
Go ahead.
My name is Ramsey, and I was wondering if you could talk about how you see other larger historical trends connecting to the future of the Palestinian people, like climate change and changes in how technology is affecting militarization.
How do you perceive Hezbollah's model in the context of the Israeli prison level of the Palestinians, and should the Palestinians emulate that model?
The Hezbollah model, and how far can the Palestinians emulate that model? Shall I?
The regional situation, it's a very important question. I mean, I think this could be a whole lecture, so I won't be able to do this, but let me just pick up on two aspects that I think are important, but they are not the only ones, by all means. On the one hand, as you're probably aware, the terrible things that happened in Syria, before that in Iraq, and still continue to happen in Yemen and Libya, distract the international community's attention. We know it's very difficult to get the world's sympathy and empathy to the Israeli against the Israeli atrocities by people saying, come on, compare it to what's happening in Syria and so on. So we are struggling with the international community to explain to them that that the Palestinian suffering is 100 years old and it's incremental and it's on a daily basis, and therefore this comparison of the last 4 years is not the right way of doing it. But that takes time, and the media doesn't have time for deep analysis, especially not the televised media. So we need to find alternative ways of explaining to people that this comparison needs to be done properly, and not the way that the Israelis are doing it, actually to push away any criticism. But there's something more profound here, I think. The main issue, as I see it, I don't know if you agree with me, but the main issue, I think, in the Arab world today is the fact that both governments and opposition movements violate basic human rights. Whatever the ideological or religious justification, there is a basic dehumanization. And one of the features of a settler colonialist project is dehumanization. One of the main features of Zionism was the dehumanization of the Palestinians. You cannot ethnically cleanse hundreds of thousands of people without dehumanizing them first. You cannot kill, as the Israelis do now on a daily basis, Palestinian children. If you don't dehumanize the children and you say these are not children, these are actually terrorists. Now, the only way the Arab world can get out of the present phase of dehumanization is with the help of the international community. I can't see the Arab world itself doing it. Now, in order for the international community to play a constructive role, you need a proper conversation about human rights and civil rights. But if you exempt Israel from this discussion, you can never have a constructive role as an international community. Because people would say to you, okay, you want to talk about the human rights violation by the Syrian regime, you want to talk about the human rights violation by the opposition groups to the Syrian regime, but you don't want to include in this conversation the opposition, the human rights violation by the Israelis, then you are not a partner for this conversation. It's very simple. I'll give you just one other example. Israel has a long border with Syria. And all the other neighbors of Syria accepted refugees in large numbers from Syria. The only country that didn't accept even one refugee, despite the fact that there are relatives, direct relatives of these refugees in the Galilee, who said to the government, come on, you don't have to pay one penny. We will, these are our brothers, cousins, we will take them in. And the Israelis, of course, did not allow it. They said this is an implementation of the right of return. This shows you, and the international community didn't find this strange, that the strongest economic country did not accept even one refugee. Europe accepted refugees. Even the United States accepted refugees. But Israel did not accept one refugee. So it shows you the kind of connections that there are there. Second question. You don't know. Hezbollah. No, but before Hezbollah, there was... Oh, yeah. The general ecological... I think you're right. First of all, I would, if you don't mind, I would take it even wider than ecology. I think that there is a clear correlation between neoliberalism and settler colonialism, not just in Israel. I think there is... I think neoliberalism is based on dehumanization and elimination of the worker as a human being. So your only consideration is cost-benefit. And you don't care if a factory is the livelihood and the center of a society in the Rust Belt or in Connecticut or so on. It's the same kind of perception. And it's not surprising that the settler colonialist project of Israel adapted itself very well to the logics that informs settler, neoliberalism in that respect. Israel tries all the time to say cost-effective. You know, they go to the Chinese, they go to the Indians, and they try to sell this securitization and high-tech and so on. I think you're right. By association, this is also connected to ecological disasters, of course. As you probably know, one of the things that the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe, included, and this is not talked enough about, is an ecological disaster. There was an ecosystem in Palestine. It was very well kept by the natives of Palestine. It had to do with the water, with the fauna, and the kind of vegetation that you could grow, and so on. There was a whole system that was kept for years. And the whole idea of Zionism was that you ecologically can turn a part of the Mediterranean into a European landscape. So they planted millions of pine trees instead of the local orchards and bustans, and they ruined the ecosystem, they ruined the ecosystem. And this goes on in the West Bank and so on. So this is part of this idea that you can turn an indigenous ecological system, not just human society, into something that the settlers want to recreate because they were ousted from a certain environment. And this is, again, not typical only to Israel. It connects to settler colonialism. Elsewhere you can see it in California, in the Napa Valley, all the kinds of carp fish that they brought from Europe. They destroyed the fish population there and so on. There's so many connections. But I think it's very important to understand that the more we are successful in struggling for social justice against neoliberalism, the more we are successful for fighting for justice in Palestine itself. And Hezbollah. It's a very, very good question. And you never, because the Israelis themselves are a bit confused about that. On the one hand, both the Hamas and the Hezbollah, this model that you have missiles that can attack the Israeli civilian population either as a deterrent, in the case of Hezbollah, or as a retaliation, in the case of Hamas, for actions that Israel does in the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. On the one hand, this kind of reality serves very well the Israeli army. It justifies its existence, it justifies the creation in Israel of kind of an army with the state, in terms of budget, in terms of mentality. So in a way, it serves the main objectives of the settler colonial project, also to say, you know, these are our enemies that try to destroy us and so on, and also works well in the international community. On the other hand, in the case of the Hezbollah, there's a real fear that the tens of thousands of missiles that Israel claims that they have can really create such a havoc on the Israeli north that it can shake the confidence of the society in its leadership. So it's very difficult to assess this model, because on the one hand, there is a certain deterrence there. On the other hand, there's a certain justification. With the risk of generalization, because you asked a very good question, should the Palestinians adopt this model? Rather than you exempted me, which is good for analyzing the model, whether it's good or bad. There's two different questions, you know. I think that the Palestinians, but of course it's up to the, first of all, it's up to the Palestinians to decide which kind of struggle. I'm not going to tell them. My feeling is that given the fact that we are already living in a one apartheid Israeli state, I think the model of popular resistance that was done in Jerusalem, the BDS campaign from the outside, the need, of course, as I said, for a clear Palestinian position, is much better adapted to the reality than the models of armed resistance, which had the logic in the 50s and the 60s during the Third World campaigns for decolonization. I can understand very well where they come from in the 21st century. I doubt their effectiveness, and I do think that gives Israel a pretext for perpetrating more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Yes.
Some people would say that Israel has too much undue influence on American politics and therefore sets policy for the Middle East. Others may argue that the United States government or whatever sets the policy for Israel in pursuit of their hegemonic control of the Middle East. Where does the balance lie, if there is a balance?
Okay, who directs whom? Israel, the U.S., or the U.S., Israel? Okay, I have to take someone off, and then I'll take you.
Yes. You mentioned the relationship between Israel and India briefly in passing, and it's a developing relationship. I believe Israel is now the largest arms supplier to India, which is significant given the ongoing Indian occupation of Kashmir, given the battles against the indigenous people in India and Operation Green Hunt, and others. And I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit more about that relationship and how it's developed. I think it's very significant internationally and not well known.
Israel-India relationship, yeah.
So first of all, thank you, Ilan, for your intelligence and for your spirit and your persistence. You do a very good job of deconstructing the sort of narrative, the Israeli state narrative, and you know, it's really helpful, useful. The one thing that was missing for me, that you just sort of touched on in the last question, has to do with the idea that if we allow the Palestinians to have their rights, to have meaningful power, they're going to kill all the Jews. Mm. Could you speak a little bit to that? And could you also say whether you think there is a developing a concerted campaign to paint Jeremy Corbyn and people around him in the Labour Party as an anti-Semite?
Okay, so
we'll
have
a
good question. The one before India.
Who controls
who? Yeah, there's a famous debate between Chomsky and Mishmeyer and Wald. I think that the best way of going around it is going back to something Rashid Khadri wrote about when he analyzed American policy in a book, I think, which is entitled Dishonest Broker, and before him, Nasir Arouri. There is a clear division of labor between Israel, or there was a clear division of labor between Israel and the United States with regard to the Middle East, which I think is one way of answering your question, which we don't know what will happen to it in the Trump era, and I'll say about it, something in a moment. But until the Trump era, you had this division which says Israel does not interfere with American policy in the Middle East because it doesn't always see eye to eye with the American way of doing things. The Iran agreement is one good example during the Obama administration, but there are many other examples. I don't want to go into them. Going back to 48. In return, the United States, and this is also true about Obama, unfortunately, does not interfere with Israeli policies towards the Palestinians, wherever the Palestinians are. And this was kept. According to Khalidi, it was even written as a document between Ford and the Israeli government, Gerald Ford and the Israeli government. So it was even institutionalized as a document. So I think, regarding of who influences whom, it depends in what part. So the Israel is dominant in affecting American policy on Palestine, but I think it's less effective in influencing American policy in the Middle East as a whole. There are other problems that inform the American policy. Trump, in a way, did not totally change this paradigm. He just gave it, if at all one can think about this man as having a strategy. But if there is a strategic thinking there, there is, first of all, taking very far the idea of carte blanche to the Israelis by his Jerusalem declaration and the moving of the embassy, on the one hand, and by softening the traditional American insistence that they have the right to have their own ideas of how to pursue a Middle Eastern policy by listening to Netanyahu on the issue of Iran and sort of reflecting in his speeches the Netanyahu references to Iran. But this could be, you know, this could be very temporary with him. I don't know how he might take the leader of North Korea with him to Tehran and build a Trump hotel in downtown Tehran as and say that this was his biggest legacy for the future. You have chosen an amazing person. I don't think any Hollywood script has ever invented such a character. India, the question of India, I agree with you, it's very important. First of all, of course, there is Hindu nationalism that now informs Indian policy, the BJP and the new prime minister, and there is a readiness to accept the kind of equation of the struggle in Kashmir with the Palestinian struggle, namely from the Israeli and Indian perspective. This is Islamic terrorism, and they share information, they share intelligence, and they share development of weapons that are really illegal in many ways in order to deal with these problems. So I think the only hope we have is a bit like the United States. India is huge. The fact that you have now a certain political elite doesn't mean that there are no other forces. I don't know how much you are familiar with the politics of India, but this is not a structure. This can change. This can change. And as you know, in the 50s and the 60s, India and China played a very different role when it came to the Palestinian liberation movement. So I think we have to keep that in mind. It is true that the arms industry is the backbone of this kind of relationship, also unfortunately with China. The opposite side of it is that both in the case of Kashmir and in the case of Palestine, the development of arms has very little to do with the ability of counterinsurgency, so-called counterinsurgency. And you know, you analyze the British almost failure to bring down a very limited Palestinian uprising in 1936, with the Israelis' failure in Lebanon in 2000, the American failure in Vietnam, and so on. You learn something from this history, that these huge mammoths of military industries do not really have the power to bring down genuine liberation movements, but they do prolong the struggle and the suffering. There's no doubt about that. The last question was, yeah.
Corbin.
Corbin.
I remember now, and Corbin. Fear, even manipulated fear, is a genuine fear. There's no doubt about that. Zionism is built on fear. In order to, first of all, to overcome the difference between the various groups, to overcome socioeconomic differences, you create fear. Fear justifies all kinds of actions. Fear also recruits the Jewish community around the world to support Israel, and therefore anti-Semitism is used as a means to stifle and silence debates. But I think the project of fear is not working so well outside Israel anymore with Jewish communities, especially, you know, with the younger generation. And in America, I think they're much more depending now on evangelical Christian Zionists than on Jews, because the evangelical Christians do not work on the question of fear. This is a direct hotline to God. Unless we can disrupt the connection, it's very difficult to convince them that God did not promise Palestine to the Jews. But inside Israel, it's our role as Israeli Jewish activists to deprogram, if you want, the Israelis, to work with fear, to contain this fear. But I must tell you that even there are kind of silver linings. It depends really where in Israel you're talking. Although it's a small place, you have to be aware that there are certain areas where things are not working too well for the project of fear. The Galilee, for instance, which has a kind of a demographic balance between Jews and Palestinians, has a lot of spaces where Jews and Palestinians interact, in the hospitals, in businesses, in shopping malls, even in schools. And the intimacy that these spaces create defeat the project of fear. Because the people you go to school with, the people you shop with, the doctor you trust your life with, and you know that the Palestinians have a presence in the Israeli medical services much higher than the percentage in the society. Almost half of the surgeons are Palestinians. So Israelis are putting their life at the hands of Palestinian doctors. So I think this creates a different kind of alternative, but it still doesn't mean that we don't need to have this huge project that has to deal with it. As for Corbyn, yeah, I think that we were as surprised as the other side was surprised that someone who's so known in his commitment to the Palestine struggle would be elected to the leader of the major opposition party in Britain and would have a fair chance of becoming prime minister. So not surprising, Israel and its lobby uses every possible ammunition in their arsenal. And the main weapon is anti-Semitism. I think sometimes he falters too easily because it's a powerful weapon. We don't understand it sometimes, maybe, because maybe it was not directed to us as it is towards him. But it is intimidating. It is destabilizing. But I think he always comes back. He bounces back. I don't think this will be a successful project. I don't think that they would force him to change his pro-Palestinian position, and I don't think they will stifle his debate on Palestine with accusation of anti-Semitism. I think he's a man of principles. He's also a politician and who wants to be a prime minister, so he will make some compromises that more purist activists would find unacceptable. But I think all in all, the bottom line would be that this could be a coup in terms of politics from above, because we have very little successes among the political elite when it comes to Palestine. We have huge successes in civil society, but we have very little success in politics from above. And this could be the beginning, together with the ANC decision to downgrade the diplomatic relations with Israel that was adopted a week ago. I wish there was severe diplomatic relations. It didn't go that far, but even downgrading is the beginning of moving in the BDS from boycott to S sanctions.
Okay. This will be the last round of questions, so I'm going to try to accommodate you all. Go ahead.
Yes.
I'll try ahead.
Okay, we were taught.
Just a minute. So
No.
Somebody's
taking
one.
One at
a time.
The first woman, so can you just
take a second?
Exactly. We were taught as kids that when Moses led the Jews out of Egypt, they wandered in the desert for 40 years till all the slaves died off and the young people went into the promised land. Do you think that there's any chance of a democratic one-state solution until the elder generation of Palestinians is gone?
Mm-hmm. I say okay. Sorry, you go ahead.
Palestinians who say that they want two states.
You said that you might touch on Gaza, and I'm wondering if you could say a little bit, help me understand what possibly the Israeli goal is in maintaining its current policy. What could they be hoping for, and what do you see as the best options for Gaza at this point?
Hi. I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit more about the state of the Israeli left and whether you think there is a role that the Israeli left could play in liberating Palestine.
Just as you mentioned, there was an ecosystem in Israel and it's gone. The fact is that ecosystem is gone globally. We are ruled by, we're living in the global fashion with lunatic people, head of the state, they're doing all kind of state thing in the...
Okay.
What's your question?
Why don't we think, not as a Palestinian or as an American or Russian, but as a global citizen, because the ecosystem is going to be a lot harsher than any bombs or anything that's coming.
Okay, and that's the last question. I'm sorry, I can't accommodate you all, but we're running out of time, so maybe short.
Yeah.
I have a question in regard to which there's 100% Palestinian agreement, and that is 4 years ago the Netanyahu government was there that a prerequisite to peace with the Palestinians was accepted as Israel as a Jewish state. At that time, all Palestinian leaders from among the Muslim town declared that they will never recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Saeed Arafat said, no force on earth can make you change my narrative. I speak for
Okay.
So the question is, since that time, Netanyahu has continued to make this demand, and so far, solidarity groups, international solidarity groups, have not
expressed
solidarity with Palestinians.
Okay.
Is it possible for Palestinians to achieve self-determination and equality without
addressing
solidarity groups declaring that Israel has no right to make
So you're posing the question also, solidarity movement, that they should ask Israel to stop asking this question.
Okay.
That the international community should ask Israel to stop asking this question of requiring from the Palestinians.
Okay.
And we'll wrap.
Wrapping it together. Make it easier.
Yeah, you don't need to discuss them.
Yeah. Okay. The question of... the Israeli Democratic State, Israeli Left, I think I got it. The Democratic State and so on. I don't think it's just a matter of a certain Palestinian generation coming to an end. There are elder Palestinian, older, if you want, Palestinian leaders who you can talk to about alternative ideas, and there are younger Palestinians who are totally committed to this two-state solution as if it's a religious imperative. So I don't think it's a generational thing. I think you're right in sort of pointing out, and maybe that's what you meant, that there is some sort, that first of all, Palestinian society is very young. I think more than almost 50% of Palestinians in Palestine are below 18. And this we don't always hear their voice, but they have a discourse. They have a discussion. They are much less confined by ideological affiliations like Fatah or Hamas or the various political parties that make up the Israeli scene of the Palestinians inside Israel. So I think there is a younger conversation that will come to the fore, I believe. More democratic in a way, more united, because they can use the internet for creating a dialogue that was not possible because of the fragmentation of the Palestinian people before. And I think this would be the major contribution to a new conversation about the one-state solution. And then I think we may have a better chance to have an international community responding more positively to this. The last ones who would respond to it positively, if at all, would be the Israelis, of course, but this is a different story. Now, the Israeli left, the question of the Israeli left, and maybe I'll connect it to Gaza in a way, and then I'll finish with the ecosystem. The settler colonialist ideology cannot be leftist, or there cannot be a socialist settler colonialist ideology, a liberal settler colonialist ideology. It's impossible. And I think that's the main problem of the Israeli left. It wants to adhere to universal values, but it wants to remain loyal to the settler colonial project, and it doesn't work. And that's why they hardly have any people voting for them, because the Israelis understand that this is not working after 7 years, this is a charade. So the only way of being a member of the left is to be an anti-Zionist Israeli. And that's not a pleasure, I can tell you. So that's not a nice position to be if you stay inside Israel. It's not easy. But there is a younger generation of people who understand it in Israel. I think they will be important. I want to mention a book by Marcelo Svirsky, a friend of mine, called From Coexistence to Co-Resistance. Very important book.
Say it again.
From Coexistence to Co-Resistance. And in this, he and his colleague, he wrote it with a friend, chart a role for the Israeli public as part of the Palestinian resistance. But again, this is not possible before we have a clear Palestinian position, for example, of what is the role of the Jews in the resistance. You know, so the Israeli left doesn't have an easy life, the Palestinians don't tell them what they want, and if they try to be a Zionist left, it doesn't work. Gaza, the Gaza Strip. I think the Israeli, if you sort of sit down with Israeli generals or politicians who are the main policy makers with regard to the Israeli strategy vis-a-vis the Gaza Strip, you will understand that for them, the strategy is almost a tactic. What do I mean by that? That they are not sort of bewildered by the possibility that the kind of relationship they have with Gaza now, which is siege, retaliation against the Hamas action, futile conversation with the Egyptians or the PA about the possible different scenario, they don't think that these are tactics. They think that this is a way of life. As I said before to my friend there, for the Israeli army, it's very important to be involved in fighting in Gaza. You can test new weapons, you can exercise your soldiers, the army is not dormant. They find Gaza very valuable in its present reality. Are they worried about the human catastrophe that is unfolding in front of our eyes? Some of them are, to their credit, they are. But because they cannot see the reality in any different lenses than the ones they're using, they sort of resign to the fact that there will be human catastrophe, and they somehow hope that there will be some way of getting out of it. They don't have a real strategy of how to deal with it because they don't have a strategy about Gaza. Gaza is a problem for them that doesn't go away, and whereas they have a clear idea of what to do with the West Bank, they're still at loss. So that's an inertia of the most horrific kind that continues. And the only way to solve the Gaza problem is to take a comprehensive look at the conflict. You can't solve the Gaza issue without solving the whole issue of Palestine. Finally, I owe this. Is he still there?
No.
He's gone. Okay. So I'll send him a telegram. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.